Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boom and Debate Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boom and Debate, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And we are here. Deborah Brown on Blog Talk Radio with the Boomer and the Vape Show. And it is Friday. It is the 22nd, I believe. Is that right, Deb? 22nd today?
Gosh, you caught me. I don't know. 22nd.
Friday the 22nd of October. And sneaking up quickly on a new year, 2010 right now. We're still in 2010, broadcasting from the Boom and the Babe Enterprises studio in Phoenix, Arizona. We're going to get to our guest in just a minute, but before we do that, I want to invite our listeners to take a peek around the Boomer and the Babe website at www.boomerandthebabe.com and see everything that we're involved in. A lot of things starting to happen that haven't been there before. They're going to be coming up shortly, so kind of follow it there if you would. And you can follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. And we generally try to get as much information out through as many venues as we possibly can. Today we have a Friday guest that we have every second or so Friday. It's Matt Bunk, the managing editor of the Arizona Capital Times. This is Arizona Friday on the Boomer and the Vape Show, and this is Politics Friday. We're going to get into some Arizona politics with Matt today. We're not going to have a chance much to do it next Friday because he's going to be pretty busy getting cranked up for the election. So we want to take advantage of getting him on today and making sure that we could get some preview of the upcoming election. So, Matt, welcome to the show. Glad to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Pete and Deborah. My pleasure to be here.
Well, I guess we could probably jump right into it. Why don't we start nice and easy? First of all, what are your plans and your staff's plans, and where are you going to be on election night? And give us a rundown on how the newspaper business functions for an election eve.
Hey, sounds good. It's hectic. I mean, as you can imagine, I mean, we're kind of spread out all across the valley on election night. So we've got a small staff. There's probably about 8 or 10 of us, depending on, you know, if you count freelancers or other folks that are helping us out on election night. So what we end up doing is, well, candidates generally kind of congregate in different areas. You know, the convention centers and the banquet halls and things like that across the valley usually have parties going on. A bunch of candidates will decide to gather at a certain place. The Biltmore is one place. You know, downtown at the Hyatt and the Wyndham are generally places that they'll have big campaign parties, election night parties. So that we'll spend our night bouncing from one party to the next trying to talk to candidates. There's probably about 5 or 6 of us that go around and shoot photos, shoot video, talk to the candidates, get interviews, and they just kind of do that all night long. And it's an intricate dance because there's so many places we want to be that, you know, I'm sort of the central hub. You know, everybody's calling me and finding out where to go next, that we don't want to duplicate efforts. You know, it'd be a bad deal if we had 5 people at one event and nobody at the rest. So it's I'm really the central router as the editor, just kind of making sure everybody's going to the right places and has all the information that they need. And, you know, the parties are fun. I mean, I as a reporter, you know, covering these things, that was the best part of the whole thing. I mean, everybody's out there having a good time. You know, if you drink, you know, people are drinking, or, you know, there's certainly food and desserts and things like that. And everybody's kind of having a good time, you know. Later on, as the night starts to wear on and certain people realize they're losing, they start to leave these parties pretty quickly. So they die out really fast after the election results start coming in, but they're really fun from about 7 o'clock till, you know, 9, 10, something like that.
So you can still be in it be relatively early night for the losers.
Oh, well, for the losers, but, you know, then we got to come back after this whole thing's taken care of. These guys all come back and you know, compile their stories, write up their quotes, you know. It ends up being like a 4 in the morning stop time for us usually on election night. You know, we go for about 30 hours straight almost, it seems like. But Yeah, it's a lot of fun. You got to make sure you get some sleep in the weekend leading up to the election, though, that's for sure.
So now what do you do during the course of the day when the voting is taking place? Is there anything that you're doing in preparation for that evening's activities, or are you chasing candidates during the day? What are you doing there?
Well, the guys, the reporters are out chasing candidates. They're largely, running around talking to voters. We'll sometimes send people out to, the different polling places and just talk to voters, get a sense of what people are doing. I'm usually back here trying to frantically plan last-minute, changes and updates to what we're going to do that night. So I don't get a lot of the fun action that these guys do. But, we're running around and just kind of checking things out, trying to track down phone numbers, getting cell phone numbers of the candidates to make sure that we can get a hold of them once the results start coming in. That's usually what we do during the day. It's boring. That part of it's a little more boring, but, preparation work.
And of course, you want to make sure that you are wherever they are, whenever they're making their announcement or concession or claiming victory or whatever they're doing. You got to make sure that you have somebody, especially with the top candidates. I would imagine that takes a lot of planning, too.
Well, that's where it gets difficult because, you have to start to time it so that you're at the right place at the right time. And we can kind of guess, which ones are going to be decided early so we can be there and take photos of these folks who are, as they're, jumping in the air for joy or shocked that they're losing. We try to catch that emotion. That's the fun part of the night. And so we're kind of dancing around from place to place trying to do that. We've done a fairly good job of guessing when or being at the right place at the right time anyway in past elections. Hopefully we'll be able to do the same thing this time.
Now, moving on a little bit to some of the other stuff that we want to make sure that we cover. Are you going to be covering... You always cover the locals, I understand that. But are you going to be covering any of the congressional or senatorial things? How much time do you devote to those, if any?
Absolutely. What we've done is we sort of identified there's about a dozen legislative races that are really close, or at least worth watching. So we... many of them are because of Arizona, as I've mentioned on the program before. Arizona's, districts, legislative districts, are so skewed right now towards either Republicans or Democrats that many of the big guessing games take place during the primary election. Once the primary is over, you can usually tell just because of voter registration figures in that district if the Republican or the Democrat's going to win in that race. So what we've got is probably about 12 races right now that are kind of tough to call. And those are the ones that people are really looking at. So we'll get a couple of people, we'll divvy those up, and then we'll also look at the congressional races. Right now we got about 4 congressional races that are really worth watching right now, worth writing about, that people are, the rest are sort of ho-hum because we know who's going to win. So another person will, a couple more people will take the, will divvy up the congressional races, and, largely these stories will be covered by the people who've been covering these races for the past several months. We cover everything statewide, the gubernatorial election, the attorney general, all that good stuff. So,
and what about the? Is there much to follow with the senatorial thing with McCain? I mean, he's already going to be declaring his victory speech, I would imagine.
Yeah, that one's kind of foregone. We know that the Associated Press and other wire services are going to be covering that race, and there's no real big questions in that. So we'll allow the wire services to run those stories. We'll pick those up. They'll be on our website, but we're going to put our time into the local races that we know are contested.
What about the race with Quayle? Is that going to be a close race? Is that something you would be covering, or are you going wire service there, do you think?
Oh no, yeah, that one we're covering. We've been breaking stories on the Quayle race nationwide, for the past several months, and we kind of decided we own. So we're going to definitely look at that. And just a quick update on that, and I don't know how truthful these numbers are, but we've looked at some polls, and it shows that race may be very close. There was some speculation that it would be, but you never know. We haven't seen a lot of public polling on this race up until more recently, and that could be a lot of fun to watch. That's John Holbert, the Democrat, against Ben Quayle, the Republican, and it's just been kind of an ugly race from the get-go. Both candidates are throwing a lot of dirt back and forth, and it's just too much fun not to cover.
that's for the John Shattuck seat, correct?
It is. It's for the open seat by John Shattuck. That's why it makes this one so much fun, is because there's, incumbents are coming into these elections with a slight advantage in many cases. I don't know if that's the case this year, but that's generally the case. Having John Shattuck retire, before this election just leaves it wide open. It's a Republican-leaning district. It should go Republican, but... we saw quite a bit of fracturing among the Republican Party in that primary when Ben Quayle was running against nine other Republicans. There not a lot of consensus. I think what happened was he won the primary with like 22-23% of the vote. So he's going to have to convince more Republicans than he has that he's the guy to vote for. Otherwise, John Holbert may have a good chance. And Holbert's been making a lot of – frankly, it's getting old for me personally. I've been hearing about this John Holbert attack Ben Quayle on about the dirty. Everybody's probably heard about that already, where he's been Ben Quayle had written for a website called thedirty.com. That's kind of a salacious website, some racy things on there. But he had done so. This is several years ago, supposedly, and this is months old dirt, but Holbert just keeps throwing it, and it may be having an impact. I don't know, but I can tell you this: I'm getting a little burned out of that one.
Well, the election's coming just in time, then, isn't it?
Absolutely.
put us out of our misery, one way or another.
Correct.
Now, talking about getting national pub and national recognition, our friend Matt Bunk has been doing some interviews nationally. Correct? Did you do something with CNN?
Oh, well, CNN would have been great. It was C-SPAN. But,
C-SPAN.
That's also – it was also good for us to do. It's fun, that you get to go on go on TV nationwide and tell people what's going on in Arizona. And I got a chance to do that and kind of lay the groundwork for the election. The segment's going to air a couple of times, I guess, up until November 2nd. So check it out on C-SPAN.
Do you know when it's going to air?
No, they told me some days that it's going to air, but they didn't tell me what time. So I my relatives are all calling me saying, "Hey, when's that going to air?" And we're all kind of just sitting here and trying to
living on C-SPAN, right? C-SPAN.
If their attempt was to get my family to watch C-SPAN from now until the election, they certainly did it. But I don't know if they accomplished much else with it.
Exactly. Well, while we're on the Deborah, do you have anything to throw in there? I got a couple more things real quick with Matt, but do you have anything else you want to toss out?
Well, yes, I do, actually. I was going to say a minute ago when you said, this is going to put us out of our misery, just have the darn thing over, it really doesn't, because people ramp up again. I've never seen anything like it the last several cycles. It's a perpetual running. Somebody is running for office 24/7. And I think it's exhausting for people who really love to watch politics. I can't imagine how you must be, Matt, because it's just insane. It's not over. It's never over.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It isn't ever over, and they are constantly running. It becomes a pitched battle in the 6 months prior to the election. But it is. It's a constant battle. The thing is always going on. People are always trying to posture for the elections and always trying to prepare for the next one. And it is. It's really tiring. It'd be nice if they'd start to work on policy and then come back and deal with the elections when the appropriate time comes. But they're just always focused on that election for sure. And the thing that gets us is it's all geared up. Every effort that they're dealing with throughout their terms in office, it's all geared up for the posturing that takes place right now. I mean, this is like the now go time for these folks, and they've been gearing it up for it for 2 years. They've been laying the groundwork, so it's just all guns blasting at the same time, and it gets loud, it goes fast, and the last couple of weeks here leading up to the election is certainly an exciting time, but it can take its toll.
Well, we know this. We know this exactly what you just said. There are certain politicians that will show up at an event and make a speech on something that's already settled or that they have nothing, they have no reason to talk about it. You know, they can't affect change at all in that area, but they'll come and, you know, like swoop in and, you know, I'm the knight on a white horse and I'm going to, this is how this is to be, and it's already taken care of, right? It's like, why are you here for this? You know, why are you putting a letter to the editor on an issue that you have nothing to do with as if you are the one that's the, you know, the arbiter of all that is true and wonderful? And it's just crazy, and people buy it.
Yep.
They just go, wow, our politicians are really working for us, and yet they're not handling policy. Because if they were, we wouldn't have so many states in the union who are bankrupt or going that, you know, have these horrible deficits. So stop running. I really do think somebody has got to put a stop to this and say, you're not allowed to campaign at all except for 6 months prior to the event. That's it. You know,
yeah.
I always have my Pollyanna thing that I say, but I just had it. You know, I just, and I'm a political junkie. I watch a lot, and I know a lot. And it drives me out of my mind.
I agree. It is absolutely true. And that's what, you know, there's so much, and even if the problem becomes, even if they're not actively campaigning, their policy decisions that they're making are preparing themselves for the election. You know, and that's the real troubling thing for, you know, and you guys have talked about that with me before and mentioned that as well. But that's it. I mean, instead of making the decision based on what they should do, they're making the decision based on what's popular. And that's they're scared, you know, frankly, to come back into election and tell voters that they voted for something that maybe the voters, you know, would have rather had them do something differently. You know, and they're constantly looking at polls, constantly looking at all that stuff, trying to make their decisions. And you know, that's, you know, in some ways that's what they should be doing because their constituents are the people that they should be trying to represent. It's good strategy to try to keep your district happy. There are some times that I think lawmakers have to make tough decisions and go against the grain, and that's where they get scared and they get nervous about the upcoming election, and sometimes I think it affects their decisions.
Well, I have one more question, Matt.
Let me ask one more follow-up on that.
The thing I would like to know is who exactly is being polled? I have never been asked anything.
Yeah, it's a very small, you know, group of people. Usually not like a
sampling.
Yes.
Right. It's a small sampling of people. I don't know if they go back to that same group over and over again to, you know, to test different questions. But the thing is, if you do that, whoever you is, the people that do that, put up that poll, and then the rest of the people go, oh, well, then that must be true. You know, that many people said that. 70% of the people say this. 70% of how many people?
Right.
And I would like for somebody to insist that the exact numbers, you know, 14 people were asked and 70% said.
Right.
The big difference from 5,000 people were asked and 70% said.
Right.
Well, Deborah, we've discussed this before, of course, and it's the old figures lying, liars figure. I mean, they can get a poll to say and come out any way they want it to come out based on who they ask and what they ask, and it's just an exercise in futility that I think because everybody has their own pollster, everybody has their own slant on it, including the pollsters themselves. So, I don't know that that's going to change.
There are two distinct types of polls, and there are. Don't misunderstand me, I guess, anybody out there that's listening. There are many, many different types of polls, but there are two subsets that I sort of break them into. One is a poll that is geared towards getting an answer that you want to distribute for some sort of propaganda reason, you know, and they can be either really leaning questions, which you would consider a push poll, which is the terminology they use to describe somebody who just gets on the phone and says something like, did you hear candidate X did this? Would you vote for candidate X, or would you vote for this candidate who says he'll do this for you and this for you? Or, you know, that's a push poll, and that's designed towards actually changing voter attitudes as you're asking the poll. There's another more subtle version of a push poll, which the questions actually sound a little more legitimate. They're not quite as leaning, but they're certainly trying to gear towards a certain result. They know that if they ask a question, they word it just a little bit subtly towards one direction, they're going to get an answer more often than not, that, you know, that they want to see and that they want to put out to the public. And then there's another type of polls where we rarely, honestly, the public rarely sees these polls. There are polls that are very legitimate that that at least the candidates believe are legitimate because they're going out asking straight up questions, questions that they know to be completely true, completely honest questions. And those results are used to guide their decisions. The internal campaign polls, or not campaign polls, but the internal polls that you know, congressional staffs will do and things like that. Those polls don't ever, you know, usually, that's just usually for internal strategy that the candidate will use. In many cases, those are the most accurate polls out there. These candidates are banking their careers and everything they have on trying to understand really what the truth is out there. And so those polls really matter. Those results, they need them to be accurate so that they can understand what's happening in their district or whatever. But what we're seeing, what the public rarely, you know, usually gets, is these press release polls from some firm that's been paid by some group to get an answer that they want to get or get the results that they want to get. So that's it. You've got to look at one of the things, and I apologize for going on, but this is one of the things I think the public really doesn't understand is these polls. And Deborah is absolutely right. That is the starting point that you need to take a look at in every poll. How many people were polled? What's the margin of error? How is the poll weighted? And there's so many different, you know, equations that go into some of these polls. For instance, they know how many Republicans, you know, what the percentage of Republicans versus the Democrats are in Arizona. And so they will weight the poll so that a certain number of respondents equals the percentage that they're trying to get of that demographic so that it can be applied more accurately to the entire state as a whole. But the fact is, it's math. It's equations. They're putting numbers in there that you don't necessarily know how why they did it. So you have to, as a reporter, as any, you know, journalist or anybody in the public that's trying to understand a poll, don't just look at the questions and the answers. Don't just look at the results. You have to, if you really are going to listen to polls and pay attention and care about them and let them guide your decisions, then you need, you know, what we need to do is really look deeply at the methodology behind the polls. A lot of times the media, you know, and I don't think our paper is guilty of this, but a lot of times the media, they'll do a rush job on a poll press release that they got. They don't tell you anything. And I would be very skeptical. If you don't see the sourcing and the questions and the methodology behind the poll, don't believe it. You're going to see a lot of TV does this a lot, and I'm not trying to nail the TV for, you know, industry or anything like that. But in a 1 minute soundbite that they typically do on TV, there is no way to properly analyze that poll for the reader and give them the information they need to know whether it's true or not. And TV doesn't filter very well. They'll throw any poll out there and tell you what the results are as if it's true. I've seen it happen over and over and over again. So it's just a matter of being really careful.
Know that, and it's exactly what happens. A lot of our leaders will stand in a forum and say, you know, 70% of the people, 68% of the people, which people, which 68%? It's really damaging, in my opinion, to, you know, have that kind of a broad brush, and then have the rest of the people just go, well, I give up then. You know, if everybody else feels that way, I guess I don't have to say anything. And that's why we have voter apathy, and, you know, it all just kind of snowballs after a while, and it's like, okay, stop the craziness, and let's be honest for a while. That would be novel.
That would be very novel. That, before, Matt, we were talking, before we got into the discussion of the polls, we were talking about how immediately after the election, Deborah brought it up, they start to campaign again. And they're all posturing, and they're all getting ready for the next race 2 years away or 4 years away, whatever the case might be. What amazes me, and I'll use candidate Quayle as an example. Candidate Quayle knew that he had done whatever he did for the dirty or whatever the hell that whatever that website is. He knew what he did. He knew that he wrote for it.
Right.
Did he for 1 minute think that when he decided to run for office, did he for 1 minute think that that wouldn't be found out? Now,
yes.
How he really did think that they would never find out about that?
Yes, I believe so.
Wow. In today's world, with all the bloggers and the people out there trying to vet anything and get dirt on anybody they can get, he really felt that they were not going to ever find out about it.
Well, I honestly think he didn't think that. I honestly think that there are many more skeletons in the closets of candidates that than we know. I don't, from our perspective in the news media, there's so many times that we'll be looking in somebody's background and find just the craziest stuff, and we're thinking, man, we've been, you know, how come we didn't know this before about this person, you know? And this stuff will just come out. Now, there's a lot of people searching through looking for dirt during campaign seasons. You know, campaigns that have whole, you know, staffs of people trying to find dirt on their opponent. Sometimes it doesn't all come out. And, you know, what really nails people in some cases is when they go back and they find out, you know, they talked to your friends back when you were young, you know. That's when things start to really come out. Well, unfortunately for good old, you know, Ben Quayle, he wasn't young that long ago. So you don't have to go back too deeply in history to find people that, you know, have connections with him that he may not be proud of at this point. And that's what happened here. The guy who runs the dirty, I'm not sure Ben Quayle, as far as I know, I mean, I don't know the history of these two gentlemen, but the founder of thedirty.com claims to be pretty good friends with Ben Quayle. And if his stories are true, it sounds like they did spend some time together and did have a friendly relationship. Hung out, you know, drank at the bars together, hung out and partied. Don't know if it's true, but, you know, some of what this guy has said about Ben Quayle has turned out to be true despite Quayle's initial denials. So you start to wonder how much of his story is completely true. So, you know, did Ben Quayle come into this campaign thinking, okay, you know, I did write for that website. He's not going to go tell the media. You know, I don't know. It's a good possibility. He used a pseudonym to write on that site. He probably thought he was safe. You know, he didn't write under Ben Quayle. That's what kind of, you know, allowed him to deny it initially for a couple of days until, you know, it turned out he couldn't deny it anymore. But yeah, I mean, these guys will you know, but that's where I think, if I can play political strategist for a moment, that's where I think Ben Quayle really kind of, his campaign really let him down, or he made the wrong decision. Because if you could come out and tell the voters when that kind of stuff happens, Ben Quayle's 33 years old, I don't think anybody would have held it against Ben Quayle. I mean, there would have been a few, but I don't think many people would have held it against Ben Quayle if he'd have come out and said, you know what, I was 27 years old, 28 years old, I did something stupid. I shouldn't have been messing around on that website. You know, it wasn't a big deal. I just wrote a couple of comments, but I shouldn't have done it. And I'm older and wiser now. And, you know, I've got a family now. I've got a whole other, you know, you guys remember what it was like when you were 20 years old, you know, or in your 20s. Are you the same person that, you know, you were then?
He doesn't have a family now. Excuse me. He doesn't
have
a family
married.
Now.
He's married now, right?
Yeah,
he doesn't have kids.
He tried to pass off those children as his.
right. Yes, he has a wife and I believe some pets, but I don't think he has his pet, you know, he has no kids.
And his pets don't care.
So, you know, it's amazing. I mean, these guys will. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, after the Politico story came out and after our story came out, he's still trying to deny it. And at that point, you need to come out and just say, you know what, I screwed up 5 years ago. If you want to hold it against me, fine. But I'm not that same guy. Whether it's true or not, that would have been a good thing to say, and he didn't. Instead, he denied it, and now he looks sort of like he was lying to people. So.
Now, there's other things that happen, obviously, and I know I asked you the other day when we had a brief time to chat before you came on the show. There's this, you're telling me is just pure, pretty much on a dead, adulterated baloney, I believe, about Governor Brewer's health, that's just drummed up apparently by somebody that has an axe to grind with Governor Brewer. Is that pretty much the case?
It, you know, John Doherty is the guy who initially put that out into the internet, basically. That you know, he put a tweet, I believe, or he put it out on Facebook or something, that Jan Brewer may have, you know, health concerns that could impede her as governor if we elect her again. John Doherty is a very, very respected journalist. I had a lot of respect. John was one of my, I'll tell you, in my early career, John was one of my heroes, and I meant that. I think John did everybody a disservice when he put that out about Jan Brewer. John knows better than that. John knows that when you say something like that, you need to back it up with some sort of factual reasoning, or you don't do it. That's a barb that you throw out and you try to stick on somebody as they're running a campaign. And, you know, it may or may not be true. And if it is true, then I implore John Doherty to come out and explain why and what logical reasoning and what factual basis he used to come to the conclusion that he did. And, you know, I think he made a huge mistake. I think that was absolutely just wrong. In turn, you know, what always happens in politics, one wrong move leads to somebody else doing something wrong. And I got to say that what's more despicable, I think, is the response from the Brewer camp when that occurred. To attack Terry Goddard on a personal level regarding his sexuality in a response to the questions about Brewer's health is just unconscionable. You know, and I run around, I eat breakfast with Chuck Coughlin, Brewer's strategist, who said these things about Terry Goddard. I think the world of Chuck. I really do. He has made a lot of enemies down here at the Capitol, but he's made enemies because he's effective and he's a very good political strategist. But Chuck has a tendency to go off the hinges, and what he did is probably, you know, there's probably some reasons, some strategic reasons why he did what he did, but it's not serving the public of Arizona. And I think both sides on this one anyway, they did a disservice to the general public by coming out and talking about these things the way they did. It's not a substantial issue in either case that I can tell.
Well, with the political climate having to do with people's sexuality and everything else that's going on nowadays, I can see why an over-exuberant or overzealous campaign strategist would say, well, let's just jump on this bandwagon. And seeing as how it's something that apparently has been bandied about someplace in the past, why not fan that thing and see if there's any spark left to it? Because it becomes all of a sudden it fits right in with all the other things that are going on and all the other the rest of the rhetoric that's happening nationally, and all of a sudden, bingo, here we are back in the middle of some kind of garbage again in Arizona. So
absolutely.
I appreciate your frankness on that topic, Matt. I think that's very good insight, and I'm very pleased to have you let us know that. Let's talk about somebody else that you indicated is probably having a little bit of a trying to position for national prominence, and that's Mr. Russell Pierce. What's he got up his sleeve? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, absolutely. This guy is never ceases to amaze me. I think the rest of us out there, I think everybody's either you love him or you don't, but he just always got a lot of surprises for everybody. He keeps us busy.
He's his own October surprise, right?
He is his own October, September, November, you know, an all year long surprise. The guy's I'll stop there. I was gonna go probably where I shouldn't on this. But what happened earlier this week is Russell Pierce came out, had a press conference to remind people. He wasn't really announcing anything new, but basically came out to remind people that he's got this idea to go ahead and end birthright citizenship for people who are born in the United States but were born to illegal immigrant parents. He says they should not be citizens and not be granted citizenship. Excuse me. And he announced this. This is actually a story that we broke nationwide several months back when he first announced it. He told us exclusively, and we had it kind of went wild nationwide after we ran our story. But he's trying to challenge the 14th Amendment. The interpretation of the 14th Amendment, basically since it was written, has been that if you are born in the U.S. soil, and you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States of America, then you are a U.S. citizen, automatically. Boom. End of story. It's one of those amendments that's not really that hard to understand. The problem is, or the thing that Pierce is seeing, is that under the jurisdiction of the United States phrasing in the 14th Amendment, he is saying that the illegal immigrants who are here, they're not under the jurisdiction of the United States. Now, his arguments are long, complex, and maybe, you know, better explained in court. But
convoluted?
Yes. And he points to things he has. There's a lot of truth. Now, Russell Pierce is not a person who will usually intentionally lie to anybody, at least not that we can tell. But Russell Pierce has a certain view on things, and he will ignore certain facts and concentrate on other facts to make his case. And so he's concentrating on some arguments about the 14th Amendment that occurred when it was drafted. But you can argue whatever you want in Congress. Doesn't matter. What's drafted is what matters. And so when you have to go back and look at the 14th Amendment and what it meant and what people intended it to mean, Russell believes that it's not, or Senator Pierce, believes that it's not the right of people to, you know, who are born here to become citizens. Now, the reason that people are saying that that this is a little bit, you know, legal experts I've talked to are saying that this is a hard row for Russell Pierce to toe, is that he's got a, under the jurisdiction of the United States of America, generally what that was said, what most people believe and what the courts have established is that that means, like, foreign diplomats who are here, who have, like, diplomatic immunity, those people are not under the jurisdiction of the United States laws. So they would not, if they had a child here, that child would not be a U.S. citizen automatically because they are not technically under the jurisdiction of the United States. Illegal immigrants, this is what happened earlier this week. Now, getting back to the press conference earlier this week, Russell Pierce, at the first question that the media asked Russell Pierce is, if an illegal immigrant comes across the, you know, the border into the United States, commits a crime, is that person under the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States? And Russell Pierce acknowledges, yes, they are. Absolutely. I mean, somebody comes up here, commits murder, we arrest him, we put him through our court system, we put him in jail. So the argument that Pierce is making, he's going to have a challenge in court to try to prove that somehow these people that are illegal immigrants and born here were not, you know, under the jurisdiction of the laws of the United States. It's going to be difficult to prove that. And
well, they're going to be under the jurisdiction of the United States, whatever is convenient for Russell Pierce to have them under the jurisdiction of the United States.
Well, it's funny you mentioned convenient for Russell Pierce, because one of the things that he has constantly said down at the Capitol is this judicial activism needs to stop. The courts need to stop reinterpreting the laws of this land and let the lawmakers do their job, and that's what they're there for. That's what the Constitution says they're supposed to do, and now we get the courts going around and upending all these laws. Okay, well, you know, if you're a critic of judicial activism, it seems a little disingenuous at this point to try to undo what the courts have believed in and what the law says. They're trying for a reinterpretation of the 14th Amendment. The reinterpretation of the 14th Amendment would come through the Supreme Court deciding the constitutionality, what the framers intended by that amendment. So he's trying to get the courts to basically be activist in this case. And he's been a critic of judicial activism since as long as we can remember Russell Pierce down here. So it's, again, it's a situation where, it's not based on an ideology of being opposed to judicial activism. It's based on an ideology of being opposed to judicial activism when it doesn't serve your purpose. And I think that's what we're seeing from Russell right now. And the long and short of this whole thing is, he's trying, I think, to establish a national presence at this point. He's already got a pretty good presence nationwide, as we've seen over the last couple of months. But he's right now teaming up with a bunch of lawmakers across the nation. I think there's 14 different state lawmakers that are involved in this birthright citizenship push that he's got going on. And they're all going to be trying to propose the same thing in their states. And this makes Russell the ringleader in some ways of this whole movement. And for these other folks, and that helps him establish a presence nationwide. That helps him build allies, build a fundraising base. And I think you're going to see Russell Pierce, and he won't say this, but I think you're going to see Russell Pierce at some point decide to run for a higher office.
A national office.
A national office. I would guess, if I had to guess, Congress.
Representing the state of Arizona.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, the world anymore is full of revisionists, and what they can't revise through the courts, they try to revise through textbooks in junior high and high schools, and sometimes they do it by just opposing it and getting it left out completely. It's amazing how many topics Young people today don't know anything about as far as history is concerned, and I'm no historian by any stretch of the imagination, but I know that there are certain things that happen, and all of a sudden, they're not even in textbooks anymore, and there's all kinds of stories that they're rampant with facts that have been left out of, and whole segments of history that have been left out of textbooks, and that is just not good. And I'm sorry, just amazes me. And now the politicians are jumping on board with whatever they're doing too.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing. I mean, you remember the history books you mentioned, you know, and what strikes me is, I guess maybe I was naive, perhaps, and maybe that's the case. But when I was growing up and I was going through government classes in high school, and even when I was going through junior high and elementary school, when I learned about the United States and what it meant to be a United States citizen, I had never imagined that there were people out there that would doubt the citizenship of somebody who was born in this U.S. soil. I got honestly admit it kind of boggles my mind, and I've seen some indications that this is a popular move by Russell Pierce. So I can admit maybe I'm in the minority on this one, but I guess I just didn't imagine growing up. I thought it was pretty clear. Never imagined that we'd be having this discussion today in Arizona, honestly.
Well, I think it's all part of the the bigoted movement of what's going on, whether it be political or otherwise. And it's people say that it's born out of frustration with the economy and everything else. But I think what happens is there's also a thought that the way you act out as a drunk when you're drunk is the way you really are. So if, taking that into account, the way you act under stress is the way you really are anyhow.
This is true. It's true. And I have to say, I don't want to sound like I'm soft on immigration. I actually believe, or I hope that I think the same thing that many Arizonans do. I think that there needs to be something done. I think that we need to stop. Like many Arizonans, I believe we need to do something about the border. And I think we need to do something fast. And if the state needs to have a hand in doing it because the federal government won't, I can understand that. But I guess some of these things that we're doing that have larger implications beyond, this in some ways changes the entire meaning of what it means to be an American, to me anyway, on the 14th Amendment thing. Can't we deal with the immigration problem without changing the definition of what we all thought America was at one point, or at least what I thought it was? I mean, there's a problem, and it's a real problem, and we need to do something. And there's many, many things that we can do. I just wonder if this is the right thing to do. I don't know this is the way to come at it.
Well, you know, there's radical elements on the far fringes, on the fringes of both philosophies, and I think what we have to do is, quite frankly, we as middle-of-the-road people, whether we're slightly left or slightly right of center, as far as our own personal philosophies, we have to, in my opinion, absolutely just abandon them and let them go out there and let them talk to their own self the way they want to talk to their own self and be done with it, and they can just preach to the choir all they want, and let them talk to each other on the blogs. But the thing is, when the press starts to get them involved and give them credence, I was watching something this morning on one of the cable stations, and who pops up as an expert commentator? What's his name, Deborah, all of a sudden?
J.D. Hayworth.
Yeah, Hayworth. He shows up as an expert commentator. Deborah pointed it out. What was the graphic they said, Deb?
Former congressman, former state congressperson or state senator, whatever he was, and then former radio talk show host. Former. So what is he now? Former. Oh, that's right. I'm a pundit, you know.
Right.
Yeah, well, the point that I think that that gets my goat on this whole thing is he has been pretty much dismissed by the state of Arizona two times politically, and he's not got a radio station right now, a radio show right now. He doesn't even have something that he takes and buys his own time on. And why are they giving him a national national voice. That absolutely amazes me why that happens. The guy's a has-been. He's been a has-been for a long time already.
Yeah, you know, the problem, and I had this discussion with a bunch of media and a bunch of other concerned, very, very concerned community leaders the other day, and we actually hashed out this exact thing. Why does the media pay attention to these folks? You know, and here's the answer, and this is what we came up with. It is nearly impossible for the media to ignore what's going on for a couple of reasons. One, newspapers have always believed that, you know, offensive, non-offensive, whatever it is, if this is something that people in power are talking about, then the public should know what's going on. So we have a propensity from the beginning to let people know, even if we think it's garbage, to let people know what's going on and let them decide for themselves. And that's what we try to do. And one of the things that, you know, you can't ignore in this whole thing is the fact that these are popular policies. Like it or not, these are popular. I mean, do the people understand the policies? I'm not sure. Would they support them if they fully understood them? I don't know, again. But regardless of you know, whatever, you know, we say here, people, you know, believe that this is the right thing to do. And as the media, we cannot shut those folks out, especially when they're in the majority. And it's really a conundrum for us, because what do you do? And I think some of the solution might be the fact that, you know, and I don't know, this is maybe making too much sausage in front of the, you know, our listeners right now, but, you know, can we write about Russell Pierce, write about what he said, but then put it in the proper context? Maybe we're not doing a good enough job of that. You know, he comes out and says things like anchor babies, and, you know, says it publicly, puts anchor babies on a press release headline when he's addressing this birthright citizenship, you know, debate. Maybe the answer is to let him say it and then let people explain in the same story exactly why that's a divisive, bad, you know, word, bad technique to use. You're just making a whole bunch of people upset by using that.
But, you know, I don't disagree with the fact that somebody in the position of Russell Pierce, he's elected, he's duly serving his constituency, and that, as much as I may not like what he stands for and what he says, that's fine. But I understand why the press, newspapers, whatever, have to let him have his voice. But J.D. Hayworth has been repudiated by the state. Why would they? Why? For crying out loud, they've repudiated him twice, and he doesn't. Like I say, he's apparently been repudiated by the radio show. Radio station he was working for. Come talk to me. I mean, you know, I can make just as much of a jackass of myself as he is. Good Lord, I haven't been repudiated by the citizenry of Arizona yet.
Yeah, that's true. You're 0 for 0. He's you know, 0-2 in the last two tries.
I haven't even been to bat yet. This guy's 0 forever. He is 0 forever.
You know, and JD, but I guess that kind of goes to the same point. And you're right. There's a difference there, especially now that JD has lost this last election too. But you know, he speaks for a large number of Arizonans. You know, and clearly he speaks for a minority. Otherwise, he'd have been elected. But there's still a large number of Arizonans who believe 100% in J.D. Hayworth and J.D. Hayworth's ideology. And so,
well, John McCain has the same ideology now. He switched to have the same ideology. I'm talking to John McCain.
I want to jump in here.
Go ahead, Deb.
I wanted to say, back when you were talking about the 14th Amendment and, you know, kind of what that means to the rest of America if people start messing with that are in place for so long, you know, that's makes America America. And I do believe that in a lot of areas we are on a slippery slope to a conversation about who is more American than the other person. You know, and who is more patriotic than the other person, based on things that are not necessarily the right reasons to even have those conversations. That's what concerns me.
Deborah, we all know the judgment of patriotism. And we all know and understand how people demonstrate that they're truly patriots. They wear a lapel flag pin and they hold their hand over their heart when they're singing the national anthem. That's the defining point. We know that. And they wear a sticker on the back of their car, a magnet that supports the troops on the back of their car. That's what makes them a patriot. We know that.
Deborah, you better tell the listeners that he's being facetious.
I'm letting him go right down whatever lane he's going there.
I thought they could tell by my voice.
I could tell. I just wanted to make sure.
Let's move on.
And it isn't. It really isn't. I mean, I think I probably helped us down that slippery slope. And I don't mean that anybody is less American because they look at the 14th Amendment differently than I do. I'm just saying personally, that's the way I understood. That was the criteria to be an American. Being born on the soil. Being one of us, growing up here, being involved. I don't know.
Regardless of your
parents, these are children, and that's the other thing, I guess, to me is that, let's do what we need to, to try to stop the illegal immigrants from being here or coming across, but good Lord, these kids don't have a choice.
What I'm saying is, you might be first generation, you might be second generation, you might be third generation, so if you're first generation, are you less American than somebody the second or third generation from? You know what I'm saying? What is
right.
your heritage? We're not going to go around and ask people that question. So
right.
that's the slippery slope that I'm concerned about. It's like, wow, do you really want to start having those kind of markers, where you're going to have to, frankly, show papers of how many generations, are American citizens in your family? I don't think so.
Right.
And not a damn one of us can go back. That have the color skin that we have, that can go back and say, my great 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 grandparents were Indians, American
right.
Indians. It doesn't happen. So
right.
let's grow up, boys and girls. I'm done with my editorial on that topic. let's talk a little bit. I know another thing that we wanted to kind of touch base on is you had some information on this foreclosure freeze stuff.
Oh, that's right. Well, this is sort of like a PSA, public service announcement. It's really important, I think, to note that, most of us have seen the news, a couple of weeks back, Bank of America had stopped foreclosure activity in all 50 states. A lot of other bank institutions had done the same thing. And what they had done is they had discovered that there were some problems in the processing of some of the foreclosures that they had completed over the past couple of years. People weren't doing the proper checks to make sure that, yes, in fact, these should be foreclosed upon, these homes should be foreclosed upon. And so there right now is a lot of confusion, I think, there's definitely a lot of confusion. Even some of the real estate experts and mortgage experts we talked to were initially confused by what was going on. What turns out, though, is that this is probably just a temporary blip. It's not going to have much of an effect long term. I think the banks are going to go back and start processing foreclosures. They've even got dates set that they're going to start doing those again. I think what they're just doing is stopping everything for a moment, making sure all the checks and balances are in place, and they're going to move on. Now, what that means for the average homeowner, probably not much. You're going to have, if you were in the process of being foreclosed upon by Bank of America, you probably got your foreclosure delayed a little while. And maybe that gave you time to, put a short sale through or something like that. But, it's not going to have a long-term impact. The one thing that people should be really concerned about, though, is that with all the confusion out there, now that people are aware that there may have been problems in the foreclosure processes, there may be more lawsuits filed. People who say, I shouldn't have been foreclosed upon, you must have made a mistake, I'm going to sue you. There's also probably going to be people out there soliciting money from people to say, hey, I can help you. The banks have stopped foreclosure processes because of problems. There may have been a problem with your loan. You should call me, pay me some money, and we'll, see what we can do to fix your, keep you from getting foreclosed on. or get your, you know, get you some sort of a settlement for having been foreclosed upon. And I think that we need to be really careful. I think the public needs to be really careful that they don't get scammed. There's going to be legitimate, probably, you know, think that we've all gotten them, you know, mortgage relief, you know, package. Call this number and we'll help you. Some are legitimate, some are not. And I think it's just really important that the public understand that if they're going to, you know, try to take some action based on what has occurred, that they understand that there are probably going to be a round of scammers coming up.
This is the latest equal opportunity scam possibility.
Right. And, you know, the Attorney General's office and a whole bunch of other, you know, law enforcement agencies are on the lookout for this, and they're telling us that they're, you know, being very careful to keep this from becoming a real problem here. But
that's Terry Goddard's office, right?
That's right. Yeah.
Okay. Just want to make sure that our Attorney General was on the job. When
he
told
says
he
is.
Not.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's another thing that kind of along those same lines, Matt. I don't know if you've had an opportunity to pull your thing out there that you were going to be looking at as far as what you wrote on. This fact check thing. You did some fact checking. It's sort of like factcheck.com or .org or whatever it is. We've got our own Capital Times fact checks, source check, whatever you call it. Tell us about that. What are you finding?
Well, we decided that there was so much, you know, so many accusations being thrown around in Congressional District 5 that we should probably take a look at and hopefully clear up whether there's any truth to some of the attacks that are going on right now between David Schweikert and Harry Mitchell. We did kind of an interesting, it's something that the Capital Times doesn't normally do. Like you said, there are other organizations that do fact checks. We sort of took and broke it down where, you know, there's three main attacks that, you know, Schweikert has lobbed against Mitchell. And so we analyze each of the attacks and try to dig in and tell people what's the real truth. And then we've done the same thing with the attacks that Mitchell has put out there against David Schweikert. So I can give you a quick rundown of what we found if you're interested.
Yes, and the winner is, and let's have the envelope, please.
You guys know there's no winners. They both, this is.
Well, the losers are the voters.
Right.
Let's see how bad we're losing.
Well, okay, so the main thing that Schweikert has said about Harry Mitchell. Now, Harry Mitchell is the Democrat who's been in Congress now for the last couple of years, and he has a voting record. There's some things that Mitchell has voted on that Schweikert can come at him and say, hey, did you do the right thing here? So what we've mainly got from Schweikert is him attacking Harry Mitchell and Harry Mitchell's ideology, and he says that Harry Mitchell is too liberal, that he votes in line with Nancy Pelosi right now, who's just a poison pill for Democrats across the nation in this election. And he's just liberal Democrat that's not representing the district. And so we looked at those, and the main thing that we discovered is that Mitchell votes along with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi about 80% of the time. Seems like a lot, but you have to take into account that the average Democrat in Congress votes with her about 96% of the time. And these figures are based on opencongress.org, which tracks this information. Schweikert says, well, you know, Mitchell just voted on all the major stuff. Mitchell voted with Nancy Pelosi. He just voted on the minor stuff against her so he could say he's not, you know, a flaming liberal. Yeah, well, that's definitely a valid point of view, but I don't know that he's completely demonstrated that that's the case. Our analysis is that Mitchell is one of the most independent Democrats in Congress, and in fact, the National Journal, a right-leaning, Republican-leaning publication, agreed with us and said he's probably the fourth most independent Democrat in the House of Representatives based on his voting record. So I think the evidence here leans a little more heavily in favor of Harry Mitchell. He may be a Democrat. He may vote with Pelosi. He may have voted with Pelosi on some major things, but he certainly is not a Democratic puppet based on the statistics. So that kind of brings us down to the two other major things that he has been attacked on policy for. Schweikert says Mitchell voted to cut $500 billion from Medicare. That's all tied to Mitchell's vote for President Obama's health care law. And that really has been the Republican, the cornerstone of the Republican campaign against Mitchell, really. National Republican Congressional Committee ran an ad that said he, you know, cut $500 billion from Medicare. It's essentially a half-truth. The bill doesn't cut benefits to Medicare recipients, but it does slash reimbursements to Medicare providers. But experts are telling us that's a continuation of a decades-old trend, and it really isn't anything significant based on the health care law or Harry Mitchell's vote for the health care law. So that's sort of a half-truth that we decided. The last one on Schweikert against Harry Mitchell is that he voted to raise taxes. And this is, again, an ad by the National Republican Congressional Committee is making these claims. You know, Mitchell, he said he's not, you know, supported any tax hikes or he hasn't eliminated any tax cuts. And in fact, he says he wrote a letter to Obama in January urging the president to extend the Bush tax cuts. So, you know, there's the health care vote, you know, that's going to impose a few more taxes, a 3.8% tax on capital gains, dividends, and other investments, for instance. But in large part, that's the main truth. That's the only truth to Schweikert's attack against Harry. So there were some tax increases, but they were in the health care bill. And beyond that, there's not a whole lot to prove that that Harry Mitchell would like to raise your taxes. He's mostly advocating for either the status quo to continue or at least the extension of the Bush tax cuts, which are the major tax issues right now in Congress. So,
I just want to kind of do this. We're a little over our hour, but that is good. No, don't worry about it. It's good by me, but it's good by you. We're having a lot of good conversation here today. What I wanted to kind of bring up, and you mentioned it in line of the Bush tax cuts, it's my observation, and I believe I don't think I'm speaking out of turn for Deborah, and if I am, I'm sure she'll jump right in here and tell me that I am. The Bush tax cuts have been in force for almost 10 years, is that correct? 8 years?
Oh, God. Something like that. I wish I had the specific date.
But I mean, it's 8 or 10 years. It's 10 years. Okay, so now the claim is that if Obama and the Democrats eliminate the Bush tax cuts from or don't eliminate the Bush tax or do eliminate the Bush tax cuts, I'm sorry, from the top 2 or 3%, that these people are not going to be able to create jobs because they are the people that can create the jobs. Okay?
Right.
Well, what the hell have they been doing for the last 8 to 10 years when they've had the tax cuts in place? They haven't done any job creation then. What makes them think all of a sudden now they're going to start creating jobs? When they just because we're going to extend the tax cut, they're all of a sudden going to see the light and start creating jobs? Somehow I don't believe it myself.
Well, you're right, and I think it's the same argument that that Democrats are making about the stimulus plan. You know, has this improved the economy? You know, you look around and you could probably make the assumption that no, it hasn't. But would it have been 10 times worse if you wouldn't have had it? You know, we just don't know the answer to that. And I think that's what the argument here is on the Bush tax cuts, is that, you know, allowing that tax to come back in the books is somewhat similar to a tax increase, because we've gotten used to this tax cut scheme in place, like you said. And actually, now that I think about it, I got my tax cut check in 2001. So I don't know when it was passed, but, you know, we were struggling a little bit ago. I think so maybe 9-10 years ago is a good time frame to consider. But, you know, it's been in place for that long. So in eliminating the tax cuts would be similar in people's minds to a tax increase right now, and during a recession, should that be the move that we take right now?
Go ahead.
No, that's it. I'm done.
Well, that's an economic question. It's quite frankly, it's one that I can't answer. I'm not qualified to answer or even try to answer. All I do know is that the claim is that they need to have the tax cuts remain in place so they can stimulate the job growth and buy their equipment and do all the things that they have to do to grow business and to help the business sector and help the economy grow. Well, they haven't done it in 8 years. Why are they going to? What makes you think they're going to do it now? That's the only thing I know about it. It just doesn't hold water to my
right
way of thinking. So
right, any argument that this is going to actually improve the economy right now, because we would extend what's already in place. You're right. That doesn't even make any logical sense. I think their main argument, even if they might be disingenuous in the way that they're presenting it. But I think largely what they're trying to do is prevent a de facto tax increase by letting the tax cuts,
right,
go off the books. So
when you were talking about Harry Mitchell and his voting record and so on and so forth, what came to mind is, by the time they start dumping all kinds of other stuff into these bills, when they say the purpose of the bill is to get all the stray dogs off the street, and in the course of getting all the stray dogs off the street nationally, what they're also going to do is they're going to build a rocket to the moon, and they're going to put a bridge to the middle of someplace else, and they're going to drill down and get oil out of the middle of Yosemite Park, and somebody votes against it, then all of a sudden they're in favor of stray dogs on the street.
right.
So, Deborah, I know where you're thinking, but discuss that with Matt briefly, and then we're going to have to wrap up.
Well, you know how I feel because I say it every time, but it's, how about just a bill that is one issue, and then when it's up or down, that's it. There's no cover, but they give each other cover by adding something that you can clearly see that does not sit well. And they get to say, well, gosh, I had to vote against it because, otherwise we would have had drilling in Yosemite. So it's got to be yes means yes and no means no, and we've been talking about this with Matt for 3 years.
And you know what? Our conversation has not gotten anything done, has it?
Yeah, they're not listening. Before we go, since I got on the tax that Schweikert had levied against Mitchell, do you mind if I come back
quickly to wrap up the
opposite?
Go
okay.
Right ahead.
Here we go. I'll go real fast. Schweikert Harry Mitchell has accused David Schweikert of being a vulture investor, and you've seen these ads probably if you live anywhere in Congressional District 5. This is like Mitchell's marquee claim against Schweikert lately. He's referencing the 300 or so foreclosed homes that Schweikert has bought since the housing market tanked. Basically, they're portraying Schweikert as profiting off the misery of people who lost their homes in the housing crisis. But most of the housing experts and real estate experts and basically any economic experts is telling us right now that, investors like Schweikert is exactly what the housing market needs in Arizona right now. They need people to come in and buy these foreclosed properties and get them off the books, fill them up. Right now we got about 10% of the million homes in Maricopa County are like empty, anything that can get people into those homes, get them fixed up, get the neighborhood revitalization going, that's going to be good for the economy. That's going to be good for Arizona. And so while Mitchell is making hay on something that is true, Mitchell's really kind of overblowing this claim, and he's not taking into account that people are going to buy. This is what needs to happen. People need to buy these foreclosed homes, get them off the books, and that's going to be good for things. And so, yes, it's true. He is, buying foreclosed homes, but, making this some sort of sinister act on the part of Schweikert, making it look like that, I think is a bit disingenuous, and that's what our analysis found. Do you want to talk about that one here?
Yeah, it is. It's interesting, Matt, that you would bring that topic up, because we have one of our Boomer Series book authors. His name is Ron Naraki. And Ron Naraki is a real estate investor, and he has a program called the TACT program, TACT. Deborah, do you remember what that stands for?
Toxic Asset Conversion and Transfer.
And he has got a method by which, I think you're absolutely right. And he's got a method by which investors, just like Schweikert, could go to a bank and say, I will take your toxic assets from you and turn it into a performing loan, okay? And I will put people in these houses, and these people will pay me because I've got an investment pool, and they will pay me or whatever the case might be, and then they whatever they negotiate for price and the whole nine. And all of a sudden, that toxic asset becomes a performing loan, and it raises the bank's rating.
Right.
That is what this gentleman, Ron Naraki, has done, and he is in the process of doing. And he has got a radio program on Boomer and the Babe Network here on Blog Talk, and it's called Wealth DNA. And he's also, the book he's writing, the e-book that he's penning for us as one of our authors, is The Ten Commandments of Investing. And we've had a long conversation with Ron, and he's doing, without being a political animal, exactly what Schweikert is doing as a political animal and doing it on the side or whatever he's doing. And you're absolutely right. I do believe that it is, for instance, if I had had a home that I was in foreclosure on, and if I could find somebody else to come and invest, get me out of the home, take care of the loan, whatever, and let me live in the home, and I pay rent, it sounds like a good thing to me.
Yeah, you know, and that's the case. You know, yes, he's profiting off this, but isn't that what we're supposed to, you know, isn't that what they taught you in business school? You know, buy when it's low and sell when it's high, and you know, it's good
high
for the economy. Yeah.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And in that respect, there might be some, that may be the only thing that I would agree if I were voting for him in that district, but. Hey, more power to him. As long as he's not breaking any laws doing it, I don't think there's a problem. And for him, for somebody to say, even though it might be one of my favorite candidates in this particular instance, for that candidate to put that kind of bad information out there is just silly. I mean, and that's just it. They can't talk anymore on the topic and on an honest discussion. They have to start throwing the trash around.
Right.
And that's just
well,
the way it is.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, what makes me wonder is, okay, 300 or so foreclosed homes that Schweikert's bought since the housing market tanked. Good Lord,
what's he worth, or where's that money coming from? That might be worth the investigation there.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm envious. That's got to be a pile of money he's sitting on. If he can hang on to that till the market comes back, good Lord, you know, that's got to be he'll be able to retire nicely.
Yeah, he won't have to worry about having a pension from the government because he served a term in the Congress.
There you go. Maybe that's what he should do. Come out and say, listen, if I'm elected, I will not take a, you know.
Right.
Okay, so attack number two. Schweikert mismanaged the county treasurer's office when he was, you know, treasurer of Maricopa County years back. An internal audit found that the treasurer's taxpayer information fund had a couple of management issues. The office didn't get multiple bids on vendors for a couple of projects like the law requires them to do. And also, two contract employees did not have the formal employment agreements provided by the county. You know, basically, they're on contract without really having gone through the procedure of being on contract. So, you know, these two of the four things that occurred that the audit found occurred during Schweikert's watch as treasurer. He stepped down or resigned or left office in October of 2007. Schweikert said the treasurer's office staff was you know, signed off on these decisions. So he's kind of passing the buck in some ways, but you know, these things are definitely true. These occurred under Schweikert's watch, and if you believe that, you know, anything that occurs in you know, the head guy's in charge and he's responsible for problems, then certainly you could put these on Schweikert. You know, are these major things? You know, I guess that's up for you to decide. These audits that states do on these departments will often find things that went wrong. These are just a couple that went wrong under Schweikert's watch. So these appear to be small bid contracts where the problems had occurred. One was something like $35,000. The other one was like $15,000. So it looks like there were some problems with the paperwork. Things hadn't followed the process properly. It's generally true if you care about those things. Schweikert, attack number three. This one's a little bit more fun. Schweikert wants to abolish the U.S. Education Department. Schweikert's campaign said he would support abolishing the Department of Education in favor of sending money that passes through the agency directly to local schools. And he said he would support a drastically reduced mission for the Federal Education Department. you know, he's even on the campaign trail said that he wants to pull funding from the department. He's questioned whether it even should exist. And here's his quote. If you love the Department of Education, don't vote for me. If you like having bureaucrats burning up your money in Washington, D.C. that belongs to the Kyrene School District, vote for someone else. So, you know, the idea that he's going to abolish the United States Education Department, you know, or that he would want to do that, well, I think that may be taking it a bit too far, although he has hinted towards that. So there's some truth to this. I mean, I think Schweikert's quote says it all for you. He's not a fan of the way the Department of Education runs. He would like to drastically reduce that mission, if not, eliminate it entirely. But he's not directly saying that. So, you know, it's true in regards to the fact that Schweikert would probably vote to reduce the department. We don't have any conclusive evidence that would say that he is going to try to eliminate it. So kind of a half-truth again.
Well, that's something that the anti-Tea Party folks have been saying about many of these Tea Party candidates, that's one of the things that they tout is do away with the Department of Education and do away with this and do away with that. So, I mean, in that regard, I guess he fits right in with some of those thoughts. So.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, Matt, it's as always, it has been a truly enjoyable show doing it with you and having fun at the expense of the politicians. and I hope we've been I hope I've been an equal opportunity offender. I try to be, but sometimes it just gets the best of me and I just can't help myself. The devil made me do it. But anyhow, thanks again for being a guest on the show. We're going to miss not having you just a few days before the election next Friday, but I know you're going to be working your backside off, and we look forward to you coming back maybe the first Friday after the election so we can demagogue all this stuff that's been going on and have a lot of fun with the results and what they said, and if the pundits are correct in the victories being the way they're going to be, the Republicans are going to have a lot to live up to.
That's right.
It's going to be like, you got it now, baby. Now let's see what your excuses will be. And
right.
and it was the same way when the Democrats were in. You've got it now, baby. What's your excuse is going to be? So that's equal opportunity as far as I'm concerned. The one that's in power is the one that has to perform. And we know what's happening, so it's just a question of whether or not they're going to put up or shut up. So
That's right.
With that, again, Matt, thanks for being on the show again today. We look forward to talking to you after the election. Have yourself a great election eve, and try to get some sleep well in advance before it so you can be ready to go great guns all the way through it. And thanks again for being with us.
Absolutely.
Thanks,
Don't
Matt.
Forget to vote, everybody. Thanks, guys. Thanks, Deborah.
Everybody go vote. You've been listening to the Boomer the Babe Show on Blog Talk Radio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring good conversation to the world. Today we brought you information and conversation with Mr. Matt Funk, the managing editor of the Arizona Capital Times. Always fun and always a pleasure to have Matt on the show. You can listen to the Boomer the Babe Show Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on Blog Talk Radio. And remember that we do a lot more than just host this radio show on Blog Talk. We also publish ebooks, publish mini books, have an online magazine. Go to boomerandthebabe.com. That's www.boomerandthebabe.com. Take a peek, sign up for that online magazine. It's absolutely free. We'd love to have you take that. And we have a lot of good information in there from a lot of our authors and other people that are submitting information to us about their topics and areas of expertise. So we hope you'll partake of that as well. And be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life. And we'll see you again on the next show. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic.